Good afternoon. On behalf of the AU Research Center, we want to thank you for attending today's presentation. This is the eighth in the series of Arts and Sciences Talks. Today's presentation is entitled Teatro La Quindicina, Stuart Lemoyne's Commedia at Home and Abroad. Upcoming presentations: on May 12th, Bert Voorhees is presenting Cognitive Illusions and the History of Science. At this date, we have no other series scheduled for this summer, but I'm sure Leslie Johnson does have some things in the works for the fall. Our FOIP announcement. According to FOIP regulations, we must inform you that today's Arts and Sciences presentation is being recorded. The purpose of recording is to allow people who are unable to attend today's session to view the proceedings via Illuminate at a later date. It is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Leslie Mayne Johnson, who will introduce today's speaker, Dr. Anne Nothoff. Thank you.
Hello. I'd like to introduce, it's my pleasure today to introduce Dr. Anne Nothoff, who's professor of English at Athabasca University, where she's developed and taught undergraduate and postgraduate distance education courses in literature and drama. She's published critical essays in journals such as Theatre Research in Canada, Modern Drama, Mosaic, and the International Journal of Canadian Studies, and in two texts on postmodern theatre, Citing the Other and Crucible of Cultures. She's edited a collection of essays on Canadian playwright Sharon Pollock for Guernica Press and a collection of Pollock's plays for New West Press. She's a board editor, board member and editor of New West Press in Edmonton and past president of the Association for Canadian Theatre Research. For 12 years, she hosted a weekly radio program on drama and developed a television series on world theatre. And more recently, she's assumed the editorial responsibility for the Encyclopedia of Canadian Theatre on the World Wide Web. This shows my ignorance. I didn't know we had Encyclopedia of Canadian Theatre on the World Wide Web. Well, it's my pleasure now to turn the presentation over to Anne. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie, and thank you all for coming and listening wherever you are. My talk is called Stuart Lemoyne's Teatro La Quindicina, Edmonton's Exotic Community Theatre. I always change my titles, so that's, I know it's a disconcerting habit, but can't be helped. So what I'll do is I'll launch into my spiel and I'll present some slides that accompany it a little bit later on. And we have a special guest here, Jeff Haslam, who's acted in many of Stuart's plays and Teatro La Quindicina, as well as in many other plays in the city, and currently in Noel Coward's Private Lives, in fact. And Stuart Lemoyne, the playwright himself, is here. So we're hoping that you'll have lots of questions to put to him about his plays and his theater. For nearly 25 years, playwright Stuart Lemoyne has negotiated aesthetic distance in Edmonton, setting common human foibles and social dilemmas in foreign and exotic locales for loyal local audiences. Lemoyne's gently satiric comedies investigate the complexities of human relationships and behavior through witty philosophical paradoxes and ironic observation. His characters deduce sensible conclusions through highly suspect logic, employing verbal acuity in the service of narrative clarity. Lemoyne initially developed his Edmonton audience through annual summer fringe festival productions and seasonal offerings by his company, Teatro La Quindicina. He co-wrote his first play, All These Heels, for the Edmonton Fringe Festival in 1982. Over the next two decades, he provided a new play, sometimes two, for nearly every fringe, always using it as an opportunity to experiment with extravagantly imaginative premises, eccentric characters, and exotic locales. In The Swift Hotel, 1990, 17 actors create a day in the life of an Argentinian hotel in 1950. The musical extravaganza Too Tall, Too Thin, I couldn't relate to that at all myself, but anyway, is set on a Malibu terrace with a complete set of barware and requires seven costume changes for the leading lady, all intensely glamorous. Lemoyne ended his association with the Fringe in 2003, preferring to focus his attention on developing a season of plays for his company, Teatro La Quindicina. By 1994, they had reached a point where they needed to solidify their main season activities at the Varscona Theater in Old Strathcona, where he has since developed a loyal and large audience beyond the parameters of the fringe. Teatro La Quindicina has been in an ongoing process of development ever since its inception at the First Fringe in 1982. The name is serendipitous. Someone happened to be reading Graham Greene's Travels with My Aunt at the time. In the aunt's colorful but shady past, she had traveled with a high-class bordello called La Quindicina, the Italian word for 15, referring to the group's bi-monthly itinerary. La Quindicina was often mistaken for a theater company. Lemoyne's company confirmed the association by adding teatro to La Quindicina and using it on the Fringe application form. When the Fringe returned the following summer, they used the same name to announce their continuing existence. The company comprises a core group of Edmonton actors who have a long-term relationship with Lemoyne and his plays and with the Edmonton theater audience, including Leona Brossen, and here they are. Some of them are on this. Here's Leona. Demena Stewart, Jeff Haslam, who's with us today, and also on the screen, and Sherry Somerville. Depending on the requirements of each play, the company has expanded to include other actors from the Edmonton community and occasionally further afield. As Lemoyne has explained, he wants to know what the people he writes for are like before he subverts them, and he does not remount his plays until he has found the right combination of actors. Lemoyne's plays rarely tour and are rarely performed by other companies, notable exceptions being a Toronto production of The Vile Governess in 1987, which won a Dora Maver-Moore Award for Outstanding New Play and Outstanding Performance, and productions of Pith at the Winnipeg Fringe in 2004 and the New York Fringe in August 2004. According to Lemoyne, there is a sense of mutual loyalty in teatro, a feeling of like-mindedness and trust. Everyone thinks at the same level and with the same intensity. Lemoyne believes that, quote, people come to the plays because they like the actors as much as they like the writing, unquote. He specifically writes his plays for members of the company, although he also exercises his freedom to diversify the cast, depending on the requirements of the plays and the availability of the actors. He plays on their strengths and what he thinks they can do. Although Teatro La Quindicina has produced the works of other playwrights, for example, Rope by Patrick Hamilton, Anatole by Arthur Schnitzler, and Hedda Gabler by Henry Gibson, Lemoyne prefers to produce and direct his own plays. He knows his audience and what they like. He has experimented with other styles, the expressionism of Judith Thompson and neck-breaking car hop, and the psychological intensity of Ibsen, Strindberg, and Wedekind in The Vile Governess, but there's always a comic spin that is distinctively and recognizably his. Typically, Lemoyne's plays feature bizarre scenarios, witty dialogue, and quirky characters, whether they were written specifically for the Fringe or not. Some are more reflective and philosophical, such as Shocker's Delight, Pith, and The Margin of the Sky. Others are what Lemoyne terms his screwball comedies, such as On the Banks of the Nut, Fidelia, and Skirts on Fire. I did some onion research after I saw Fidelia. Since it's the name of an exotic onion. Lemoyne described his screwball comedies as, quote, fast-paced, intricately plotted, and peopled by characters who retain a literate air even under absurd amounts of pressure, unquote. He believes that even in the most grim of circumstances, there may be humor. Someone always has some darkly comic comment to make. Too many contemporary tragedies are completely bleak. The audience understands the message and sees the importance of it, but they're glad when the play is over. Lemoyne prefers to keep his works engaging and humorous at many levels, side-splitting or whimsical. In Shocker's Delight, for example, although two of the characters are given to wisecracks and jokes to evade important issues, they have to adjust to a more serious level. The imaginative distance may be considerable, but the plays are grounded in a psychological reality. Most of Lemoyne's plays are set in the past, often in the 1940s and 50s. He grew up watching all the old movies on TV, and his plays are informed by film and television as much as by literature and theater. He is cognizant of what people want to see when they go to the theater, and this may not necessarily be contemporary situations. Much can be said about the present day and the unchanging aspects of people by showing them in past contexts, like the reverse of Shakespeare in modern dress. The use of a traditional genre can provide a certain distance for the observation of human foibles. According to Lemoyne, it's also a way of reminding people that this is one way that they can be, whereas if a play is set in the present, the implication is that this is how people all are. Moreover, it can be exciting just to see a period genre recreated live. Film noir in When Girls Collide, or gothic romance inspired by Anne Radcliffe in The Spanish Abbess of Pilsen. Lemoyne's advice to his audience is uncomplicated. Quote, I asked Stuart if he would enact this part, but he thought that maybe he would be undramatic, so I have to read it. So on now, Stuart. Just watch these people. They're going to enact a story for you, and you can take whatever you want from it. You can say, how did they ever walk in those shoes? Or what was it like back then? In the 1950s era of Shocker's Delight, for example, it was racy to go out in a boat on a date in a boat and drink, whereas now it looks quaint. So there's some kind of authenticity as well as period charm. Unquote. Lemoyne's plays have a distinctively philosophical bent. How to recognize the choices, how to achieve a balance between what appear to be different or conflicting values. There's often a reconciliation at the end, a recognition of integrity and honesty. Marcus, in Shocker's Delight, like the wise fool in Shakespeare's plays, appreciates the value of using time wisely and the infinite possibilities which may lie ahead. In his last speech, floating on a lake in a boat, suspended in time, he experiences a moment when he lives in harmony with himself, his friends, and his environment.
I am most content at this moment, in my boat, on the little lake. It's quite peaceful here, and that ought to be odd. The boat rocks, after all, and changes direction of its own accord, and the flimsy construction of the vessel really does seem to leave it ill-equipped to keep me from sinking into the water below. Still, it manages, and through this small artifice, I am allowed to be at one with nature. I see this as a paradox of the modern world, and floating too seems to me to be most paradoxical. Whether an object floats on the water or on the breezes, its situation is quite precarious, yet peaceful at the same time. Right now I see Fritz and Elfie waving at me from the shore. Soon I'll row in and we'll have a splendid picnic with fresh bread and cold meats and very fine cheese. But I am loath to leave my spot here on the lake, and I don't think my friends will be too put out by having to spend a few more moments alone together. And so I put my diary down. I put aside all my reflections. I close my eyes and scarcely breathe. I am at peace, and so I float.
Lemoyne's plays are inquiries into the nature of friendship and love, finding that they are very much the same, but for particular circumstances, and that logic and reason are ineffectual in matters of the heart. There's some sadness in this realization, but also some happiness in the recognition of the power of these feelings and how they can change lives. Not to admit the importance of these feelings can result in disaster, as Marcus discovers in Shocker's Delight. In all of Lemoyne's plays, the creative imagination is a means by which fantasies become psychological realities, often transforming lives and offering the possibility of hope and redemption. As he has pointed out in respect to these plays, three plays published in 2004 by New West Press entitled A Teatro Trilogy, and I'm enacting Stuart here again, all feature sequences that are the product of the character's imaginations. In The Margin of the Sky, the bulk of the play turns out to have been Leo's idealized version of a day he'd rather be having. And this is what's on your screen is from The Margin of the Sky. It's actually the cover of the published text. And so here is Leo. He's the Canadian playwright. In Chalker's Delight, the Biedermeier game playing is where Marcus finds equilibrium and refuge from illness and unhappiness. In Pith, Virginia is taken on a fantastic imaginary journey as a means of dealing with an overwhelming emotional obstacle. I think in all three, there's a kind of eventual transcendence, where the characters come to realize the difference between what is real and what isn't, and gain a kind of enduring strength from it. In Pith, the imaginary journey from a manor in Rhode Island to a hotel in New Orleans and the jungles of Panama and Ecuador, during which a grieving, closeted widow and her intrepid Nancy Drew sidekick meet an assortment of strange and exotic strangers, is accomplished on a bare stage with four chairs and a Victrola, testifying to the powerful illusions of theater. The master manipulator of illusions, the mysterious sailor Jack Vale, again this was played by Jeff in the production, plays many roles as he guides the two women through dangerous adventures to a more positive future. Equatorial nights may be long, but the sun always comes up. Many of Lemoyne's plays respond to the question, well, what if this happened? But there's also a grounding in reality, often in the casual incidents of the playwright's life. Lemoyne's experiences in the United States anticipate Leo's in The Margin of the Sky, being asked for assistance by another customer at Tower Records in New York, being bemused by the surreal, frenetic, cool ambience of Los Angeles while not quite connecting with an actress over a scriptwriting opportunity. Lemoyne locates his ingenuous characters in the United States or in exotic foreign locales to show their response to seductive but dangerous social and cultural systems and to explore their potential for independent self-realization. In The Margin of the Sky, he places the different cultural perspectives in the United States and Canada in ironic juxtaposition. Leo, the quintessential Canadian playwright, with the propensity to see irony in everything, finds he cannot accommodate the melodramatic and violent scenarios required by Hollywood. But he can appreciate the infinite possibilities of the imagination and the human heart in A Sunset in Music.
A margin is an edge. And on a piece of paper, it's a line that marks an edge. But it really only has meaning because it denotes a point of entry. You put your pen where the margin tells you to, and that's it. You're in. So the margin of the sky would have to be the point of entry for everything above. That's why you can never say it's the least significant part, any more than you can say that the door is the least important part of the house. It can't be. The sky is huge. You can't pick a place to get into it just by looking up. But if you look straight on, you can let yourself think that there really is a part of the sky that touches this same earth on which we're all standing. You can let yourself think that if you traveled the distance between here and there, you would actually get to it. Now, experience tells us that it doesn't really work that way. But standing here right now, I can't see a reason why it's not possible. And I think I'm all the better for that. The sun sinks down to the margin and it exits the sky. In time, it approaches the other margin and gets back in. I want to do that, too. I want to go back to the beautiful place and enjoy the view and then come back. I think we all do. And right now, if we're willing to look into the distance, it should seem to us as if we can.
Leo, the Canadian playwright, finds a way of entering an imagined space through language. Distance provides accessibility. The casting of Ron Pederson, and here's Ron Pederson, as a Canadian playwright who tries to succeed in Hollywood, also provided an ironic edge for the Edmonton audience. He had previously worked with Lemoyne's young company Teatro Bambino and had returned to his hometown from a television acting gig on Mad TV. The recognition factor significantly heightened the comedy. Lemoyne's plays may also speak to a local audience in other venues and on other occasions. In 2003, a monologue from his two-hander, The Exquisite Hour, was read by popular local actor and teatro associate Jeff Haslam at the Memorial in Edmonton for Shakespeare scholar John Orrell. Orrell had been Lemoyne's English professor at the University of Alberta and was an enthusiastic supporter of Teatro La Quindicina from its inception. No doubt they had shared an interest in the ways fantastical scenarios can be played to a local audience. And in many ways, Lemoyne's comedies echo the verbal acuity, imaginative confusion, and strange locales of Shakespeare's comedies. The Exquisite Hour, however, is set in a very local landscape, a suburban backyard on a late summer day in 1962. Purported encyclopedia saleswoman Helen Darramont intrudes on the quiet solitude of bachelor Zachary Teal as he sits drinking lemonade spiked with bourbon. I tried it. It's pretty good, actually. She breaks down his defenses by appealing to his imagination. The encyclopedias can take him away from the quotidian reality and transport him anywhere in the world. They can introduce him to a multitude of new experiences and new possibilities for interaction through the imaginative creation of scenarios to play out with others. Like the history of the Swabian family Hohenstaufen in Württemberg. More importantly, she finds some words to look up, right, and he discovers all these possibilities. More importantly, like the exquisite hour of the production of the play, the books can occasion reflection and engagement with life. Jeff will read from the exquisite hour.
The sun's going down there, and you can see the way it's just lighting across the tops of those trees. It's one of my favorite things to look at. It's just a few minutes every day, and they may come at 4:30 in the winter or closer to 8 in the midsummer, but I've always thought that if I was pressed to pick, I'd say it's one of my favorite times of the day. It's just a good moment that you can always count on, even though the day's pretty much played out. But I'm worried now that it's not going to be the same. It's now going to always remind me of this particular moment, and it'll never be quite good enough. It's hard to know what to do when you've realized that a particular hour of your life is maybe one of the best that you're ever going to have, and that every wonderful minute you get to live of it means there's now 1 minute less. How do you get that to stop happening? Somebody invented the hour, and I guess the minute and the second as well, and I suppose they thought it'd be just great to have all this control over when things happen, but couldn't anyone see how we'd all just be losing and losing and losing? I've lost so many hours, Mrs. Darramont. So many hours and days and weeks and years, and I hardly took notice of it because they were all pretty unexceptional. And what's a few more minutes gone at this point? Well, I want them. I want to keep them. And if having them means losing them, then maybe I'd just rather always be about to have them. Why aren't those kinds of hours available? Why can't somebody cook up that kind of time?
I'm all choked up. I won't be able to continue. That's a very moving. Thank you. Stewart's latest play, At the Zenith of the Empire, produced in November in 2005 at the Barcelona Theatre, was inspired by John Orrell's history of early Edmonton theater, Fallen Empires. In January 1913, at the age of 68, Sarah Bernhardt performed the death of young Parisian courtesan Marguerite Gauthier in the fifth act of La Dame aux Camélias by Alexandre Dumas Fils at the Second Empire Theater in Edmonton, Alberta, for one matinee and one evening show. She was on tour with Martin Beck's New York Company, providing a tragic finale to the vaudeville acts, which comprised the first half of the show. Some of these, the titles of these vaudeville acts are hilarious. The price of the theater seats doubled to $3. In her journal, her response to Edmonton was euphoric, despite the, quote, ferociously piercing cold, unquote. And she prophesied, quote, with remarkable rapidity, Edmonton will become ravishingly beautiful. Unquote. Stuart Lemoyne brings Bernhardt and her vision of Edmonton into the present in his play, At the Zenith of the Empire. Bernhardt's ironic comments on the conditions under which Edmontonians survive point to a tenacious local pride and the opportunity to, quote, live free of old notions, unquote. Her observations on the vibrant Edmonton theater scene in the early 20th century anticipate the current scene and posit the social value of theater practice and attendance. Lemoyne dramatizes the constituency of the local theater audience and its response to her performance in the form of three women. For Bernhardt, Alberta's daughters are her muses. She finds her inspiration in the community in which she makes her theater, as does the playwright Stuart Lemoyne. All the possibilities for tragedy and comedy reside in Edmonton, as we all know for sure, as she observes when she first encounters her adoring fans. Now I'm Bernhardt. I should have imported Leona Prosser. Are these the muses approaching to ignite the flame of pathos and humor and truth which will rage throughout the ensuing spectacle? Well, no, they're not. These are Alberta's daughters, not Menosanes, but I think they are every bit as lovely. With the help of, I'm Arrow Challenger, assistant to the associate theater manager, Bram Jarvis, and architect, Peter Ingram, here's, guess who this is? She tours the city in a wheelbarrow and marvels at the impossibilities taking place. For example, the construction of the high-level bridge linking Strathcona on the south bank of the North Saskatchewan River to Edmonton on the north. She observes that it will take the people out of the valley, quote, who have no imagination or purpose or ambition, unquote. For those who stand on the bridge and observe the vista, it will not spoil the view. She compares this experience with being aloft in a balloon over Paris. This was a notorious balloon ride she took that scandalized people at the time. She urges the theater manager and the architect to create the community of the future by writing plays and designing beautiful buildings, one of which happened, the other probably didn't. On her visit to Edmonton, Bernhardt is accompanied by her current leading man, Lou Tellegen, a posturing Dutch actor with French pretensions. From his location in Winnipeg, where he and Bernhardt had played for 6 days on the tour previously to coming to Edmonton, he laments the impending visit to a place that is even more remote and arduous than Winnipeg. Quote, it's so far north of here, it shouldn't even be possible for people to live there. He voices the uninformed attitudes of those who fancy themselves more urbane, sophisticated, and cosmopolitan, although he began his own career as a dock worker in Rotterdam before acquiring his persona as an actor. Bernhardt, on the other hand, who identifies with the challenge provided by unlikely situations, playing Hamlet in drag, for example, counters his negativity. And yet they do. Their motto must surely be, con men, just as mine has always been. Edmonton is not even so far north as Denmark or St. Petersburg. And wasn't that where you spent the happiest days of your life? At the Zenith of the Empire is a portrait of community theater practice and audience response, showing the intersections of the past with the present. As Lemoyne points out in an interview with Edmonton Journal reviewer Liz Nichols, the play is not so much about Bernhardt or the Empire as about the audience. Quote, uncharted terrain, really, the people who go to theater, why they go, the dynamics of the group, the ones who go out of duty, the ones who go to everything at the Empire. In a city like this, not everyone was savvy about the theater, but everyone knew who Bernhardt was. His audience is enacted by three devoted theater fans who typically attend performances together. Well, that's another one of Lou Tellegen. And this is where he's showing the theater audience. He's flipping around the theater configuration. These are the three ladies who represent his audiences. Lillian, a wealthy widow and socialite who has seen Bernhardt in other performances and who prides herself on her knowledge of the theater. Winnie, a librarian, from Strathcona, which is perceived to be the other side of the river in this bay, who relates personally and emotionally to theater performance, and Celia, the straight-laced and parsimonious Scot, who has some reservations about both classical and experimental drama and prefers light entertainment. And here's Winnie and Lillian. Lillian has brought her own jam to put on the oat cakes supplied by Cecilia because they're completely impossible to digest. They're so dry. The playwright has obviously, over the years, been observing the Edmonton audience who observed his plays. From the perspective of loyal audience member Winnie, Lemoyne champions the local theater scene and its importance to community building, even though Winnie appreciates the attraction of the imported hits from the United States. And this is Winnie. It's so nice to see the familiar faces on stage, and the plays are always funny, and prices are quite a bit lower than at the Empire. You can make invidious comparisons here, but I will resist. Winnie also sees films that The Empress, another of Edmonton's six theaters, converted to admit the newest fad in entertainment. Her treasonous behavior is deplored by her friend, Mrs. Lillian Barnes, the self-dramatizing theater aficionado. Lillian also provides insight into the Edmonton amateur theatrical scene before the establishment of proper theaters like the Empire, foreshadowing the plethora of contemporary theater activity in the city, particularly the Friends Theater Festival. Her doubts about new experimental theater groups using found theater spaces are still current, and this is Lily deploring the use of anything other than a theater for theater. Everyone was always putting up the most ambitious things in the oddest places, like the back room of Mr. Parrish's granary or in the upstairs hall at Ferguson's where they had the temperance meetings. It was so ridiculous as to be most entertaining, but I don't think it's entirely apt to call a place a theater just because of the congestion of people in it who are all facing in the same direction. Or the ladies here. Through the responses of Bram, the theater manager, to the telephone inquiries of potential customers, Lemoyne also satirizes the unreasonable assumptions and expectations they may bring to the theater. In his other guise, Bram is an incipient playwright who will write a play about Bernhardt's visit to Edmonton, a Lemoyne in the making. And this is Bernhardt suggesting that he go ahead and write his play about her coming to Edmonton. Finally, Lemoyne celebrates the interaction of local theater artists and community by deconstructing his characters as actors in his own theater company. Teatro La Quindicina has cultivated over time a loyal audience which readily responds to the fantastical style of the plays and the quirky personas of the actors. Wrong one here. Moving ahead. Leona Brossen, a comic character actor with a talent for ironic intonation and grand gestures, played La Divine Sera as Dea Ex Machina. At one point in the play, demonstrating the financially efficient device of role doubling, she plays a waiter, serving lunch to theater fans Peter Ingram and local actress Azalea Claymore, two community members who constitute her audience, enacting a common contemporary thespian experience. What's this? Have we no one to take this role? Oh well, Sarah Bernhardt has surmounted the impossibilities of Hamlet, and she will not shrink from this new challenge. And when she performs the menu, which features roast beef and beef soup, she's obviously playing to an Alberta audience. It is a strong beef broth in which barley and vegetables are suspended. It possesses boldness and humility in equal measure. Peter and Azalea feel nourished by her words, even before they eat. The operatic gestures of theater aficionado Lillian Barnes were ironically played by opera singer-actress Sherry Somerville. And the reservations of the least enthusiastic theater fan Cillian McCourt were hilariously rendered by Coralie Cairns, a versatile actress who has played in nearly every Edmonton theater in a wide range of roles. As the architect, who doubts the viability of Edmonton, Jeff Haslam is also well known as a theater practitioner who has based his work in the community for the past 25 years and has often played, again, with leading lady Davina Stewart. I've got my slides a bit out of whack here, but here's Jeff and Davina in various encounters of the heart. At the end of the play, all the actors appear as themselves and present Bernhard with roses in a tribute to a life in the theater that endures through performance. So here are all the actors then appearing as themselves. They take off their costumes and come out as theatrical actors at the end of the play. It's quite a moment in theater to see the costumes come off and the actors appear playing their own persons. Lillian finally learns from Sarah Bernhardt that the performance of La Dame aux Camélias does not and should not constitute the zenith of the empire. The pragmatic Cecilia explains that the implications then would be that the theater will all go downhill in Edmonton after Bernhardt is gone. In fact, even though the empire in which Bernhardt performed would eventually be demolished, like most other architectural historical sites here, theater has continued to expand and to experiment in the city in a variety of venues. Lemoyne gives to Bernhardt an elaboration of the final words in John Orle's history. So this is the final words in the play are kind of extemporization on the final words of John Orle's history of the Edmonton theater. That the empire is beautiful is not to be denied, but I think it could come down tomorrow and the loss would be less profound than you'd expect. All that was most valuable here is gone by the end of every night. It's taken away by the people who came here and watched and listened. These buildings that we call theaters, some last, some don't, and this is surely how it's always going to be. But the thing is to see that whenever you may lose one, you find another. A smaller one, a bigger one, it doesn't matter, but they must always be replaced. At the Zenith of the Empire is a witty meta-theatrical and meta-historical exposition of the importance and significance of community theater practice. It interrogates the many intersections of theater and community in the past and the present. The theater history of the city comments on and underscores contemporary practice and makes a compelling case for the future. Thank you. Now, I'm very pleased now to open up the floor to questions, comments, and especially directed towards Jeff and Stuart Lemoyne, who are here with us. Just the microphone. Oh, we have a silent audience.
We're all stunned. It was great. But I'm not sure how to ask an intelligent question. I'm only an anthropologist.
We all are, in a way. Yep. Oh, sorry. I didn't take Shakespeare with him. I took English drama from the mid-19th century. But yeah, he read some Shaw. It was just great. He knew it was accurate. But also the storytelling was pretty amazing in between.
Yeah. I took a Shakespeare course from John Orle.
Oh yeah.
He would drag students up from the tables and bring them to the front of the class to try to illustrate how complicated it is to block a scene with 20 soldiers on a tiny space like the globe space would have been.
Right. Yeah, he didn't make anybody act in our...
No.
Didn't have to do like the second Mrs. Tanqueray or anything like that.
Okay. My question is, I've noticed over the years that your titles, the titles of your plays often play off of titles of other plays. Like, I remember seeing at the Citadel a play by Albee, The Cocktail Hour.
Oh,
Right. And I noticed that Anne read a play that, give title play that also had the word hour or something hour in it.
Exquisite Hour.
The Exquisite Hour.
Yeah.
That was, in that case, less inspired by a play than by a poem which had been set to music. It's a poem by Paul Verlaine that's set to music by Reynaldo Hahn, and that was sort of the inspiration there. So it wasn't necessarily like that. A better example might be something like When Girls Collide, you know, which I just thought of one day walking down the street, and it had nothing to do with the movie When Worlds Collide, but it was appropriate nonetheless for the play.
Stuart, you use quite a small cast, and often they're asked to do more than one role. If you had your druthers, would you, and you know, money wasn't an object, would you rather have a larger cast, or do you really enjoy the challenge of the small cast?
I think that it varies from project to project. Sometimes you just need a big cast. Like at the Zenith of the Empire, we had to have 8 people. I mean, we could have had more, but that was what we could afford. And because it was a play about a lot of people being excited about something, and you can't necessarily have, say, 4 actors and then, you know, 3 of them having to run around and change costumes all the time to create that sense of you know, just a big group of people who are all going to something and who are kind of worked up about it. We started out at the Fringe doing shows that had quite big casts because we were willing in the 80s and we were all starting out to you know, all make $200 and have the best party ever. So we would do musicals and things like Cocktails at Pam's that had 11 people.
The Swift Hotel was,
Swift Hotel was 17. Some of them were children, so they didn't mind not making much money. But so it was fun to work on that big level, but you know, realistically, working in a small theater in Edmonton, you do want to get paid. But I think even the notion of doubling up characters, like having actors double up in roles, has to make some sense within the play's construction. It has to be part of the fun. Like a play we did called Connie in Egypt, which was about one character played by Kathleen Rutzart, who was visiting Egypt, and Jeff and Davina played everybody she met, from the travel agents that booked her through all the people she met in Egypt, and that became sort of the tour de force. Because I don't like it when somebody in the cast plays a second role just because they don't happen to be in that scene. And if there's not a connection between the two characters, it's just kind of jarring, you know, when somebody thinks, you know, the policeman looked like my dead husband. You know?
I think, though, even if we did a whole season of plays, and we do 4 plays, we probably would not. It's a great challenge for an actor to be in a play with just 2 other actors, another one other actor in it, or something like that. I mean, a lot of Ibsen's great plays in his second era of writing were all really small casts, and those are where some of the greatest roles in literature come from, and so those are fun to do as well for that reason. So it's nice to mix it up.
Yeah, although it took 20 years of Fringe shows before it occurred to me that maybe a 2-hander that lasted an hour would be an appropriate thing to do at that festival. Oh, but we made money that year, though.
Stuart, I wanted to ask you about adaptations.
Yes.
I can think of at least one play that you've written that's an adaptation from another source, one that Anne didn't mention, the Book of Tobit.
Yeah.
And then The Exquisite, or The Zenith of the Empire is, although maybe not adapted from...
It's inspired by an incident. I think what I like to do is something where you have a lot of room for your own imagination. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just dramatizing a novel or something like that doesn't seem to me as interesting as, say, a project I did at Graham McEwen, where I wrote a big chunk of the Orlando Furioso, which is a great big epic poem that goes on for, you know, 2 big volumes from the sort of Italian Renaissance. But to fish out all a bunch of little stories from that and intertwine them, but totally be able to make a lot of it up myself, that's what interests me, rather than, say, working on something where, you know, the scenes and the dialogue are already well worked out by another author, where you're trying to want to bring that accurately.
So you don't have aspirations to being a Hollywood scriptwriter?
Well, no, I think that's that's a different thing. I mean, you can do your own fiction there as well, and also it's a different challenge. I just actually got a job doing something fun like that last week, doing comedy punch-ups for a movie about chihuahuas. And that was great. They were just people to me. Yeah. Just make these chihuahuas dialogue funnier. That was kind of the only direction. But I think I made the heroine less shallow as well. So, you know, it's all kind of fun and adventure, and that was an interesting way to actually sort of jump into that particular pool without having to start from the ground up. There. But I think, you know, I don't think movies or TV, you can be as original there as you can in a play.
Jeff, do you have a favorite part in any of Stuart's plays?
Well, I would probably say, I mean, it's so hard to choose. Some of them are larger and some of them are smaller. I love doing it at the zenith of the empire because it seemed to be like a full circle exploration of why we're all here as artists. I think Pitt was a huge thing to get to do because it was, you know, just simply about somebody who is selfless enough to help someone else and save their life. And through kind of using their imagination and putting on a play, which is what we actually do for a living anyway, and I think is the main purpose of why I do what I do for a living. And also, you know, Pitt was such an adventure going to itself, all the cities it's played in now, and playing in New York. And we played last year, and this time last year we were off-Broadway at the Lion Theater doing Pitt and kind of bringing a little piece of teatro in Edmonton to New York and then Toronto and Ottawa as well. So that whole journey has been a real highlight. But I also loved all these plays. The Margin of the Sky and The Exquisite Hour, the whole concept that in that final monologue that chokes me up every time I do it, and every time I ever performed it, just, you know, anyone who's moved to a certain time in their life where they suddenly are cognizant of the idea of an hour or a month or a year and what you've done with it and what you could in the future do with it, is encapsulated in that monologue. And so these plays that have these ideas in them that move me so much are certainly highlights. But one of the funnest things I ever did in my entire life was the three productions I was in of Cocktails at Pam's, which is a much larger play with a cast of 11, and it's all real time. It takes about 75 minutes, and it was this huge cocktail party in the mid-60s that goes completely awry. And it's, I mean, I've just never heard audiences laugh that hard in my life. And it was kind of one of my earlier introductions to working with teatro and playing to sold-out houses that would just kind of laugh so hard that they looked like sheaves of wheat being blown around by the wind because they were wiggling around so much in hysteria. And it's just the way Stuart structures things. And the lines were all really funny. And, you know, all of those plays are such a treat to do, and I think they gave people just a really good laugh, and, you know, that's incredibly valuable as well. You know, Skirts on Fire and On the Banks of the Nut and Vidalia, as you mentioned earlier, those are all so much fun to do. They just fly like spit, and they're such fun plays to perform.
Can I just ask Anna a question? I'm curious what reaction you get when you go to international conferences and you talk about Edmonton's theatre scene. I mean, people must, in the academic theatre world, people must be aware of the reputation of the Fringe, I assume. But beyond that, what reaction do you get talking about Edmonton's theatre?
Well, then there is an awareness amongst my academic colleagues of that Edmonton has a very active and vibrant theater scene, but so much in the life, you know, the theater life in Canada is Toronto-centric still, and the interest still, the academic interest still seems to be centered there as well. So it's for me, it's an ongoing project. Okay, the rest of this country exists too, and great stuff is happening, and I'm going to shove it down your throats. You know? I'm going to talk about it some more, because I think it's, you know, it's great stuff, and it should be better known. Stewart's plays have been, you know, they've been published and they have been produced in Toronto and you're saying Ottawa with Pitt and whatever. But I think they should be way more current. And other playwrights here should just be more current across the country because they're so good. And I've seen stuff in London, you know, and other theater centers that I don't think it's anywhere near as good, quite frankly, you know, in my unbiased opinion. So that's what I see, my project. And I think there's certainly a level of interest. But it's still a kind of a, you know, it's still an ongoing project, basically. I suppose in any, you know, in any area of interest, people are obviously more, they'll come to stuff if they recognize it or they know something about it already or it strikes a chord in them or, I mean, if you sort of look around at who's in this room kind of thing, I mean, people probably, most people in this room have probably been to see a theatrical play, so they want to explore a little further kind of thing, but that's just the nature of the human beast, I guess, too. You have to find a way of connecting with people's own interests and showing how this can support that or make it even better as well. Let's say the first plays my husband saw in the Fringe started going to the Fringe was the Cocktails at Pam's, and then he's been hooked on theater ever since. So you know, since then he's been seen thousands of plays. So he still remembers it as just a hugely funny and entertaining play. You know.
Do you think that your plays are getting more serious?
Are getting more serious?
Yeah. Less of this funny, witchy, laughing back and forth, and more. I mean, there is always humor there, but it seems to me that they're becoming more poignant, maybe. Or
I think that. Well, I'm more comfortable doing that kind of thing. You know that. The funnier stuff was what was easier at the beginning, I think, and then to sort of be able to use that whole sort of emotional vocabulary came later. But I'm not concentrating on it that way. We've done some things that were like that lately, but that some of them were older. Like we just did Shocker's Delight, which came right after Pip, which was right before we did Feverland, and those were all sort of those plays that have big emotional payoffs. But one was from 99 and one was from 93 and one was from 97 and they were all revived in 2004, but I think it might have seemed like I was pushing that a little harder than I meant to. I don't think they're going to get more serious at this point, but, you know, so no. I think the point is always to mix it up and sort of find different ways to do that and make sure that if they are poignant that they're still kind of hilarious at some point.
I mean, I think Shocker's Delight is a really good example of that because on the one hand it's so fluffy and funny and light, and then, wow, you know, that really packs a punch. So,
Yeah, well, sometimes those of us who have that ironic sense of fun fall harder. I think that's certainly true of Julia and Marcus and Rory in Shocker's Delight, all three characters. Well, certainly Julia and Marcus at any rate. I mean, they're there for fun and they're great fun and they're so in their heads that they just don't see life leaping up and grabbing them by the throat until suddenly it does. And yeah, that's what makes it such a fascinating play.
Yeah, I think, too, that happens with the audience, right? You're all along for the boat ride and having a good time, and suddenly, wham, you get hit with a golf ball. And
yeah.
You had to make some adjustments.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you find your audience has changed at all over time? Because you're obviously observing your audience, and I just wondered, have you noticed any differences? over time?
No, not well. I think that audiences that here are very. I guess they know us well, so the response is often very quick. They know when to laugh and they know when not to, and you know, and we take things sometimes on tour and everyone's terrified to laugh for the first few minutes.
Or just not even terrified.
Yeah,
just not.
Just.
They don't get it.
All those words.
Yeah. And they don't realize necessarily, you know, and then they figure it out and it's fine. But also there's a point. I guess these things that have been mixing humor and seriousness that we've been doing, they have a way of, the audience here really knows when it's time to calm down and listen and get serious. And so I think they're really, we've got them under control. It's not what I'm trying to say, but, you know, I think they've had to have that learning curve as well. But our audience was always interesting to us because we started at the Fringe and we were all a younger company and sort of what you would call, I guess, alternative theater. And yet our audience always didn't seem like an alternative theater crowd.
Yeah.
They were always, you know, grown-ups with jobs and, you know, academic people and just, you know, people who were interested in something beyond theatrical experimentation. So I think that helped us to be really solid in what we were doing to build the company.
It was kind of funny when we performed Pith the first times in Edmonton, people would be laughing from the very first. Well, I start, Jack Vale starts the play with this long monologue at the beginning where he just introduces you to the world of the play, and we would do it here and people would be laughing right off the top. And, I mean, the first line is, you've heard of Jack, who is every inch a sailor. Well, that's not me. And people would just laugh and laugh and laugh and continue on. And it would be complete silence everywhere else we did. And then as it would go on, I mean, people would just listen so hard. And I was talking with Wes Borg at the Winnipeg Fringe just about that kind of interesting phenomenon. And it certainly wasn't disappointing for us. We love it when people listen. It doesn't have to be a laugh riot all the time at all. Never second guess your audience. But, he just said, well, there's that little section of that opening monologue that just makes you listen so hard, that makes you realize that you're in for something completely different. And it was this little bit, and I'll just read it to you. More than anything, I'd say that after a few months in the exclusive company of coal stokers and stevedores and the like, I craved the society of ladies and gentlemen together and the eloquent communication which takes place in situations of moral constraint. You know, and it's just like, oh, I didn't listen. You know, and it's just a nice, beautifully constructed little piece of language that compels you to listen.
Wake up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I think the audience here, because they recognize you as the actor, so when you say you're not Jack was ever into sailor, they go, well, no, of course it's Jeff Haslam. I mean, there's that kind of double stuff going on too.
Probably.
Because, you know, as you were saying earlier in this quote, Stuart, you know, the audience comes to see the actors as well as the play, and they enjoy seeing the actors in these different roles, and so you're kind of playing into that. I don't know whether you play into that, but that's a factor
not
in the audience.
Consciously, not consciously.
Yeah. Has there been a radically different response to any of your plays in the Edmonton? You know, like where it's the same play over, you know, the one run, and the audience response has varied from one night to the next?
Well, only when we've revived shows in the main stage season that originally premiered at the Fringe. Because the Fringe is such a party, you know, and Edmonton in February is a very different place, and so you don't expect the exact same response as you do from the Fringe, which is just so heightened, don't you find?
Yeah, you're doing six shows and they're all sold out, as opposed to, you know, a 3-week run of houses of various sizes and that kind of thing. But at the same time, there's a great satisfaction in taking some of the Fringe shows and being able to build a proper set and rehearse them for the right amount of time and, you know, really get to know the play better, because the Fringe, you sort of parachute in and do it and hope the lights all go on when they're supposed to, and, you know, and as electric as that experience is.
And it is electric.
Yeah, but sometimes you kind of wish you'd been able to put up a wall as well as a door. You know?
I've noticed that when they do the French holdovers, it's never the same thing at all. If you see the play during the French, and then you go to see it in a holdover, usually the audience is not very big, even though it's been sold out. Mm-hmm. The play might have been sold out every night at the Fringe. When it's held over, not nearly as many people are inclined to come. And the audience response is again, more subdued. It isn't that.
Yeah.
I guess it's because it's not part of that the festival kind of.
Yeah, we had a mixture of experiences that way, because some of ours did sell out, and that was great. And sometimes, a couple of times, we kind of got stuck in venues that were just a bit awkward or too big. So it was nice to bring it back to the Barscona and know that everybody could hear, you know, that kind of thing. So.
Yeah.
It always paid off that way. Or you just wanted to do the play some more. You know, you did you work on it for 3 weeks rehearsing it, and then you only get to do it for 1 week instead of two or three. So, you know.
Any other questions? I know Jeff is performing tonight. I think the opening night of of Private Lives. So
yes.
he's probably anxious to.
I have to quickly go memorize my line.
The grain is here.
That's great. Everything's great.
Any questions from people in the off-site spaces? Okay. Oh, I have to turn this.
So seeing none, I guess we'll assume that everybody off-site has enjoyed the show, and we'll take it from there. Are there any other questions or comments or discussions that we have here? In that case, we'll thank everybody very much. I really, really enjoyed this.
Thank you.
There are some goodies, food and... Thanks for doing that. It makes a big difference. You know, a real accurate needle. It's always great to hear that play come alive again. Thanks very much for your help.
Thank you.